You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is the 9th of August, 2023, and this is Matthew Raphael Johnson. I have to note that my manager has requested that I make another appeal for donations. This is a tough time of the year for me, but well, it's nothing compared to what Sven is going through. Of course, I have him on a monthly automatic withdrawal. Actually, she took care of that too, thank God. So our problems pale in comparison to his. But still, I request your assistance to keep me going, to keep me on the air, and to keep me completely independent. As I've said 100 times, you guys are the only reason why I'm independent at all. And of course, that would include some of you have donated directly via Patreon. And then, of course, you know, your subscribers. So, but 1 month you put in a certain amount of money and go back to your normal subscription rate after that. That some people have done that as well. So anything you can do to help, I truly appreciate it. Now, speaking of independence, I want to talk about its precise opposite. And specifically today, we're going to talk about the anti-religious campaigns in the Soviet Union from a couple of very specific points of view. But I want to start off with an expression of utter dependence. And that is, and even uttering this is depressing. And this is the address of the Russian Orthodox Church to the Soviet people on Joseph Stalin, on the occasion of Joseph Stalin's 70th birthday, December 21st, 1949. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm going to read a few paragraphs, and I want to reach these levels of delusion. Shouldn't surprise us anymore. But it goes like this. Dearest Joseph, on the day of your 70th birthday, when the nationwide feeling of love and gratitude towards you, our leader, teacher, and friend of the worker, has reached a special zenith, we in the church feel a moral need to join our voice to a powerful chorus of congratulations and express to you those thoughts and wishes which make up a particularly precious part of our spiritual wealth. As citizens of the great Soviet country and faithful children of our people, we first of all deeply honor the feat of your multiple sacrifices made without regard to yourself. For the freedom and happiness of our people, we see this as an exceptional act of strength and dedication of spirit. It is especially dear to us that the whole world now sees the triumph of your moral actions aimed at the realization of the common good and justice, as opposed to anger, cruelty, and oppression, which dominate the obsolete systems of our enemies. Thus, the triumph of justice is revealed to us in your wise and firm leadership through the beneficent transformation of the country. Your desire for the common good animates the far-sighted foreign policy of our nation and is aimed at establishing a long and lasting peace among nations. Your consistent struggle for equality of large and small nations indicates a deep faith in human dignity, regardless of race, nationality, religion. It shows your tireless care for the individual, manifest in government measures to protect public health, to raise children, and to protect the elderly, which has earned the respect of workers worldwide. Understanding that at every step your noble efforts aimed at making the life of our people peaceful and happy, we see in your personage not only a great statesman and leader directing the life of nations to new heights, but also a fatherly, caring guardian of all aspects of our human life with its diverse needs. Testifying about your attitude to all of these needs, we first of all, with a feeling of deep satisfaction, pay tribute to the rights and duties of the citizens of the Soviet state enshrined in your constitution. Among these rights to us in the church, there's unrestrained freedom and the opportunity to practice our Orthodox faith, as well as a full civil recognition of our Orthodox clergy. Thanks to your constitution, church people in our country can not only freely exercise their ecclesiastical ideals, but also take part in public and state life. The Russian Orthodox people stood up even more firmly for the interests of their great motherland, and due to the freedom of the church's activity, thus give you even greater thanks for the attention on your part to the needs of the Orthodox Church. When the question of the canonical leadership of the patriarchal authority developed, despite countless worries and anxieties of wartime, you personally received, in September 1943, the three chief hierarchs of our church and favorably treated their plans for the improvement of church life. You convened the Bishop's Council in 1943 when Metropolitan Sergius was elected Patriarch of Moscow and all Russia. Now, that's not the whole thing. That's about three quarters of it. But when we hear so many examples of that kind of slavishness, that kind of almost pathetic dependency in our own time with some of our own people, it shouldn't really surprise us. Now, I don't want to, I normally don't join the chorus of people who condemn Sergius or anyone like that, given the punishments that would have been meted out to anyone who disagreed. None of us have any clue what life in a gulag was like, to be erased from the country, to be erased from your own history, familial and otherwise, and to be tortured to death as so many were. Not everyone has that kind of strength. And who knows what we would do under similar circumstances. Nevertheless, even that doesn't seem to justify the ridiculous level of slavishness messages like the one I just read. But it was typical. Of course, the fact of the matter is that millions of Russians, Ukrainians, etc., were in the underground church or the church abroad, and that itself was a massive sacrifice, knowing full well what could happen to you and what could happen to those who organize these things, including the underground synods. So with that in mind, I want to go over a few things. I've translated a few things, and I'm working on a paper called The Elimination of the Remnants of Capitalism Campaign, Stalin's Godless Five-Year Plan and Its Successors in the USSR. I've said many times, Vladimir Moss is probably your top guy when it comes to the new martyrs. He has volume after volume after volume on the topic, which he gives away for free. I, however, focus on the political and economic foundations and ramifications of these policies. So we've read that ridiculous message to Stalin, and now we get into the reality. There was a major decision in the USSR with the approval of Stalin on May 15th, 1932. That was the Godless Five-Year Plan, led by the Union of Militant Atheists. And what it stated was that by May Day 1937, okay, just a few years later, the name of God must be forgotten on the territory of the USSR. And that's a direct quote. Now, it always struck me when I was in grad school, 30 years ago, I started almost today, maybe next week, I think, in St. Louis. But because Marxism has such a powerful economic foundation, for better or for worse, why the fanatical destruction of orthodoxy? What would be the point of alienating tens of millions of people, especially in the agricultural regions? And we're going to get to that here in a minute. And the simple answer right now is that economics is not the foundation of this. The Luciferian Promethean doctrine of men becoming God is. If you read my book on the Soviet experiment that the Barnes Review published, I go into great detail on precisely that topic. Economics is how the Soviets couched their rhetoric what we've also talked about on this show and many other places, of the scientific agenda behind it all and what it all meant. But the fanaticism was clear. Immediately upon seizing power with the aid of the Western world, both Lenin and Trotsky immediately began the attack on Orthodoxy. As this is going on, the capital synagogue, Mariina Roshcha, was built in 1926. Now, initially, and I think this is accepted universally, the initial thrust after the war was over is that they relied simply on naked force. That there wasn't really a clear program, scientific or otherwise, for the destruction of the church. They just knew it had to go. Of course, we can never discount the heavily Jewish nature of the old Bolshevik leadership. And the ritual murder of Tsar Nicholas and all that that implied. And it shouldn't surprise you that the initiative for this, as early as 1921, came from Trotsky. He created the Commission on the Council of People's Commissars for the accounting and concentration of valuables. They don't say church valuables, but that's what's meant here. It was a plan to destroy the church by demanding they give away all their valuables so they could be melted down and used to feed the starving people, who, of course, were starving because of their own policies. That was, of course, an excuse, but very typical of the left in terms of their basic dishonesty. It was only an excuse. No money was sent to anyone but themselves. In February of 1922, after the resistance of so many in the church, the decree of the separation of church and state, that was Lenin's doctrine here, mass closures, wholesale robberies began of the churches. And yet even this didn't lead to what they had expected. You had substantial resistance at the leadership of Patriarch St. Tikhon. You had uprisings. You had the development of the Catacomb Church as a direct result of this, realizing that the frontal assault is not going to work. I mean, they never avoided terror tactics, of course, but they began to single out and notice leftist clergy or vaguely sympathetic clergy in order to create schisms and then attack each part separately. All the schisms, renovationism and otherwise, have roots within the Communist Party. So, but prior to what we talked about, the address to Stalin and the creation of the Patriarchate, that, of course, was long after Tikhon. Prior to that, the Soviet Church was called the Renovationist, or the Renovationist Schism, and was outrageous at the time that this was immediately recognized by the Patriarchate of Constantinople, despite it having very few members. In fact, we've talked about this elsewhere, that the Patriarch in Constantinople demanded that the clergy adhere to Renovationism. Renovationism began essentially by proclaiming that Christianity and Marxism are completely compatible, that Marxism, in fact, has a Christian foundation, and then it ended with them being complicit in the destruction of their ecclesiastical opponents, which is almost everybody. It gave the Reds, again, you heard that in that address, the church was them, and therefore anyone outside of their Soviet church was a schismatic, and hence they had a justification to destroy them. Even more, it gave the Bolsheviks the pretext to destroy their enemies. When Tikhon was alive, he was attacked every day in their controlled state press. The OGPU began recruiting leftists, even within the clergy, for the episcopate, building its own church early on, knowing and even assuming that the naive West, which helped build them to begin with, would just accept them and say, this is the Orthodox Church here. What do they know in the West? So the Central Church Administration was led into pure chaos. And of course, we all know what happened in 1927, the declaration of then Metropolitan Sergius. He even added various communist holidays to the church calendar. Again, I'm not judging him here, but that's simply what happened. He was under tremendous threat to do what he did. In his mind, at least in his justification, he thought he was saving the lives of clergymen. But the demand for loyalty was a tactic of renovationism, because there was never a moment where the Communist Party considered changing their tactics, or even changing their idea that Christianity had to be destroyed in their new utopia. As early as 1927, the 15th Congress, by that point, Stalin condemned the weakening of the anti-Christian campaign. It's not really anti-religious, anti-Christian campaign. He said this weakening is unacceptable. And he stated, he said a year later, he said that he wanted to link a broad mass anti-religious campaign with the struggle for the vital interests of the masses. That's a direct quote from him. And as collectivization began, the attack on the church was the religious element of it. Collectivization, of course, was a miserable failure. They had no intent. This wasn't to increase agricultural production or to rationalize agricultural production or even make a factory out of it. It was to destroy or possibly enslave the peasantry, the best of them, the more independent of them, into collective farms and even using artificial famines to make that happen. Everything was marshaled to justify and bring about the regime that they wanted. Now, collectivization was this economic foundation for the collective farm system, and it tended for a while to overshadow their battle against the church, but the two of them, both collectivization on the one hand and the destruction of the church on the other, were two inseparable components, especially when it comes to the campaign to break the peasantry. The famous proclamation that the priest and the kulak are the twin enemies of Soviet power. They were long designated, before Stalin, as two sides of the same metaphorical coin. Collectivization really began in 1929, and you had a secret circular that was written by the party called On Measures to Intensify Anti-Religious Work. Now, the name Godless Five-Year Plan, well, it was unofficial, but it was popular, and it did connect those two elements, religion and economics, unified in the destruction of the peasant farmer. But earlier than that, 1922, there was a commission called the Committee on the Execution of the Decree Separating Church and State, which, of course, came after Lenin's doctrine, and it functioned officially until 1929. Now, this commission tightly controlled whatever Orthodox group was favored at the moment, and they were placed under strict surveillance, and its permanent chairman, longtime chairman, Emilian Yaroslavsky. That's, of course, not his real name. His real name was Mene Israelievich Gubelman, who I probably don't have to tell you was not born a Russian Orthodox man. But besides being the longtime leader of the anti-Christian campaign, he became the personal historian and editor of Stalin's works. He was the core historian, in other words. He wrote, in 1923, he wrote How Gods and Goddesses Are Born, Live, and Die. And he wrote, and a couple of years later, he wrote The Bible for Believers and Non-Believers. And he became influential in the West, which shouldn't surprise anybody. So after 29, questions of religious policy were considered at meetings of the Secretariat of the Party Central Committee. So regardless of what was going on, it was an extremely significant, and it was a high priority. Now, the Union of Militant Atheists was created out of all of this, and it was meant to act as a semi, you know, almost like a private organization, expressing the progressive aspirations of the population. In other words, they tried to make believe this was somehow a spontaneous outgrowth, but every bit of it was entirely supported by the Soviet state. And, of course, Yaroslavsky Gubelman was at the head consistently. Even the first half of the 1920s, the Union of Atheists was created. And in December, as early as December 22, Bezbozhnik, which was their journal, just simply means the godless, was created and edited by Gubelman, and it existed for almost two decades. Yaroslavsky, as early as September of 23, talking about the anti-religious struggle in the countryside, his idea was to put forward circles of Milton Daphius imported from the cities and have them function in the countryside as if they're from there. And this issue was in the Bezbozhnik newspaper. And they had a meeting of the Society of Friends of Bezbozhnik, which was convened in Moscow in mid-1924. But it was in 1929 that they changed the name to the Union of Militant Daphius, of course, under Gubelman. It had its own central council. It had some, it had, you know, unremarkable thinkers like Peter Krastikov, Ivan Svartsev-Stepanov, who was one of the, actually, and P.G. Smidovich was one of the founders of Birobizhdan, the Jewish homeland in Asia. And really, these guys, they're unremarkable thinkers, but they were malleable. They were useful. And they were often used to impose Lenin or Stalin's opinion on organizations elsewhere in the country that didn't want to go along. And the slogans that they came up with, there's really two of them, and it shows you how close these two priorities were. The first was, through godlessness to communism. In other words, you know, there's a clear connection between those two things. And the second, the fight against religion is the fight for socialism. So this group tended to not reject the economic foundation, but that the attack on religion is just as important as the economic foundation in building this new Soviet utopia. In June of 1929, they held a Congress where this so-called five-year plan came into existence. The intensification of the class struggle sometimes was code for, among other things, an attack on the destruction, the destruction of those who most vehemently opposed Soviet power. Needless to say, the church was first among them. So the Union of Atheists essentially played a propaganda, almost a camouflage role to justify this anti-Christian movement. And then, you know, second half of the 1920s, then to rationalize collectivization. I guess the theory was, and you have people on both sides of this question, the theory was you destroy the peasant's attachment to orthodoxy, he will then become far more easy to manipulate. Which is, I think, clearly the case. 1929 was a pretty important year. The seven-day week that year was replaced by the six-day week. So you're supposed to work for 5 days with a hypothetical day of rest on the sixth. And there were very few rest days once Stalin's plans were imposed. And of course, Sunday was gone. Even reforming the year, starting from year zero, from the first year of the proletarian revolution, and most revolutionary leftists from the French Revolution to Cambodia stopped using the older method of reckoning years. Peter the Great was the first one who imposed calculating years from Christ's birth, as we do now. And then that went to the next step, years starting from the year of the revolution. But Gubelman had a problem with that. He wasn't sure if that was ever going to work. In fact, the six-day week never quite took root in anywhere but the big cities. So you know, Gubelman himself said, well, the 1929 would then be the 12th year of the new era. And they never created the proletarian era, you know. But just like in the West, they took from the birth of Christ, you know, BC, AD, and they changed it to precisely what they use in America and the West, the common era. And the West started doing this, and it was imposed on, you know, academic institutions and things in the U.S. starting in the early 1990s. So the common era, you know, CEBCE began in the Soviet Union from the Union of Militant Daphius starting in 1929. It didn't quite catch on, unlike in America where it caught on immediately. People still use BCAD as a matter of habit. But in official publications, that's not what you're supposed to do. So the scheme here for the five-year plan of the Union of Militant Daphius, and this was approved in early 1930. And here's what Gubelman says. This is a piece of his report. He says, the process of complete collectivization is associated with the liquidation of a significant number of the churches. You can never separate this process from the fulfillment of our five-year plan as it goes along, parallel with the process of collectivization. Again, that refers to the idea, as I've said before, you know, that the church is the locus of resistance, the spiritual element of Russian nationalism, the core of it, as St. John of Kronstadt said many times. Collectivization could really only go smoothly, if it can go smoothly at all, if the peasantry didn't adhere to this tradition. Collectivization was supposed to be possibly the result of the destruction of the church. But as it turned out, it was reformulated to serve as that element that severed the connection between peasant and parish, which was a big deal. That was a secondary concern. Now, the 17th All-Union Conference of the All-Union Communist Party, which went from January to February of 1932, dealing with the main tasks of the second five-year plan, so that'd be 1933-1937, did include something called the elimination of capitalist remnant in people's minds. And of course, that also included religious belief. In fact, it may have primarily concerned it. And the Executive Bureau of the Union of Militant Atheists, which had strong official standing at the end of 1932, they approved a number of methods and decisions for a frontal attack on the church, which never really went away. What they're doing is institutionalizing it more and more. And they said, by May 1st, 1937, the name of God must be forgotten throughout the entire territory of the USSR. This was a brand new, and this was a specifically deadly stage in the construction of a totalitarian state. Totalitarianism can't function unless it is based on the denial of God in the spiritual realm in general. Because, of course, the state can't control the spiritual realm by definition. It's not a material matter. And certainly God is more powerful than any other system. Therefore, either you abandon totalitarianism, it is inherently a leftist phenomenon, you either abandon it or deny God. Now, I don't know how reliable this is, but the Union of Militant Atheists had about 5 million members. In among 60,000 cells. You never quite know, because these are official statistics. And the myth, what I've taken aim at 100 times, that Stalin somehow wanted to support the church, was a nationalist, and all this nonsense, the membership card you would get from the union would have quotations, anti-Christian quotations from Stalin's writings right on it. And you had a massive circulation of anti-Christian literature, you know, books and papers and journals. 1927, they published maybe 700,000 copies, you know, printed sheets. 1930, it was 50 million. And Bezbožnik in 1931 reached 500,000 in terms of its circulation. It had a magazine, too, which was about 200,000. Again, you could print these things and send them out. How popular they were is another matter. You could say they have 5 million members. That could just be a card in somebody's pocket. And then there was a five-volume collection that was put together by Yaroslavsky Guberman called Against Religion in the Church, published by the State Publishing House. The first volume came out in 1932. Of course, all their publications were from official publishing houses because there was no other in existence unless it was strictly underground or brought in from the outside. So the Militant Atheists denied, of course, you know, they denied religion abstractly, but their only real concern was the Orthodox Church. They had to replace that with something. So when the cult of personality started to develop, they supported it without deviation. In fact, they published literature on it, they published books on it, they funded events that supported it. They claimed that this comes from membership fees, but the reality is that the main funds and the resources were allocated by the state. And I have a feeling, and I'm almost positive this is true, that because no dissent was ever permitted against their propaganda, I think over time, they began to believe that their position was intellectually unassailable. Because we haven't heard anyone fight us on it. And it's very much like the American today, certainly the American leftists, but even just the average American person floating around out there discombobulated because everything is so tightly censored. These people live in a bubble and they start to think that that bubble is reality. And what's allowed in the bubble must be the only thing that exists. So many people have never heard our point of view because the regime has gone very far, taking great steps to keep them from it. That's why sometimes when we talk to normies, they go a little bonkers. They've never heard this. They don't really know how to react. And it's the same here. Because no dissent was permitted, anything that these groups did, they started to think that, well, our point of view is obvious. How could you possibly disagree with this? This is science. And of course, it was all done in the name of science, whether social or otherwise. And then afterwards, they began to build entire school systems, special education systems for training personnel in these attacks on the church. And the first, it was even a university, Rogozhsky, Smolensky district of Moscow, it was established. They developed shock brigades. In 1931, there were about 3,000 of these, although half of them were in Petrograd or Leningrad. They had their own factories. They had their own collective farms, although more than 300 of them, though I don't know what a godless collective farm, how that differs from just a plain old collective farm. But they had their own institutions, of course, all established by the state. Now, by the end of 1932, there was a plan to reach 8 million people in the fight against obscurantism and clericalism, and even 10 million. Despite mass famine, despite total totalitarian rule, despite peasant uprisings, this was their big priority. Although from the Soviet point of view, it does make sense. Russian orthodoxy, Russian nationalism were really one and the same. You can't really have one without the other. The entire culture is permeated by it. This was the only real foundation for serious rebellion against Soviet rule. Therefore, it was a top priority. The 17th Party Conference, 1932. We've mentioned this. You know, we mentioned that they had new directives for this classless socialist society. And they were planning this by the end of the second five-year plan. The plan for the liquidation and by 1937. And keep in mind, though, that this was never publicly published for tactical reasons. So the plan went like this, that very same conference that I mentioned. So 1932, 1933, all churches, prayer houses of any type, were to be closed. Both using, you know, the Union of Atheists, Militant Godless, as well as other state bodies. A year later, 33 to 34, and this is strange, the religious traditions had to disappear. That is, you know, instilled in the school curriculum, remake the family, all, you know, this kind of thing. Not like Kollontai did in the 20s, but, you know, the complete elimination of any reference to anything like this in the school system. And then by 1934-35, the entire Soviet Empire had to be daily, especially the youth, exposed to anti-religious propaganda. In 1936, the last members of the clergy were to disappear, and so as 1937 dawned, a new age would begin. That was the plan at that the 17th Party Conference. Of course, it was extremely naive. They were as naive as Western Christians were at the time. Because they started believing their own propaganda, they think that, well, the church really doesn't have strong supporters in the country, and the only reason that they're supporting it is because they want the landlords to return. Of course, the landlords were the peasantry at the time of the end of Tsar Nicholas's reign, but they were shocked out of their little bubble when the census that was conducted in 1937 contained an item on religion. It was included on their questionnaire by order of Stalin directly. And this is after a full decade of massive destruction. So out of 30 million rural citizens, over 16, 84% describe themselves as believers. 69 million in the cities, half said the same. Despite being aware, now these are people who are citing this on an official census, knowing full well that it's simply not possible to admit this. So, of course, these numbers are much higher. And they're probably inflated. They're probably repressed by the party anyway. So clearly, so let's say 84, let's say it's 95%, and let's say 75% for urban dwellers. That's probably more accurate because, you know, most people aren't, you know, really are worried about putting that kind of answer, knowing full well the churches are being shut down all over the place. And these numbers prove to Stalin and everyone else that their campaign and their plans were a failure in this respect. So Stalin repressed the census. He made those responses secret, and that was never publicized. And so he decided to get even more violent, more blatantly terroristic with his measures, which, frankly, were more familiar to the Bolshevik rank and file. Most people who studied the records suggest that the years 1937, 1938, that was the height of the physical terror attacks against clergy and church buildings, including the so-called loyal followers of Metropolitan Sergius. Because once supporting the Soviet state, once you no longer are of use to the Stalinist system, you get cast aside. He was now deemed unnecessary. And a lot of these figures come from back in the 90s, the Yeltsin Commission, the president of the Russian Federation, Rehabilitation of Victims of Political Repression. That was the commission that was established back then under Yeltsin, where a lot of these records were unearthed for the first time. And of course, they all seem to suggest that Joe McCarthy was right, and that the American press, the American academics, as well as Britain and elsewhere, were criminally complicit in covering over or ignoring or even rationalizing the level of totalitarian oppression within the Soviet Union at the time. But 1937, 1938, 106,800 clergymen were shot. So the point was to reduce the number of clergy to a manageable size. And the Union of Militant Atheists, they were no longer seen as this popular group that just spontaneously created. Their facade began to fade. Second half of the 1930s, the initial enthusiasm within the party began to wane as well. The collected contributions, quote-unquote, which are probably directly taken out of pay in factories, decreased by about 10 times. The Executive Bureau, the Central Council of their organization, they stopped meeting entirely. In fact, spring of 1936, there was talk of abolishing the Young Atheist system. So 1937-38 was this apogee, but there were problems within their own atheist institutions prior to that, a year prior to that. Stalin, and I don't even want to go this far, but remaking the entire culture was not the best way of going about fighting the Trotskyites and other either real or imagined enemies, especially, you know, given the year, 36, 37, 38, what was happening in the rest of Europe, further persecution. It just simply wasn't cost effective anymore. Because people like Hitler, people like Francisco Franco and others were talking about Stalin's totalitarian system. So many exiled clergymen were siding with Germany as it resuscitated itself. That's when Stalin pretended vaguely, I mean very vaguely, to be something of a nationalist, to regain his dwindling population. Hitler's popularity was a call, and people noticed this. Certainly Stalin never saw him as a real threat, and he had every reason to ensure Hitler fight against the West rather than himself. Plus the fact that the new calendar without Sunday, as well as a new figuring of years, was never accepted by the citizen body. Everyone had figured out, except in the West, that this was to enslave the population to his industrialization program, which turned out to be, Western companies investing in the USSR anyway. Since 1939, when Hitler and Stalin invaded Poland roughly at the same time, that new calendar system was abolished. Actually, it was June of 1940. And they pretended to install an 8-hour working day, 7 days with a week with a day off on Sunday. But you know, rather than this kind of manipulation, they'd have a very, very harsh ban on unauthorized absences from work. One way or the other, it was going to be a totalitarian system. But that was a result of cost-benefit analysis, the fact that the earlier attacks on the church had pretty much failed. But none of that, none of Stalin's rebranding, is very weak though it was, didn't lead to any kind of rejection of the fight against the church. 1938, the Union kind of revived a little bit. You actually held a plenum of the Central Council. 38, 39, and they adopted a program to intensify their anti-Christian activity. So you see these organizations waning and waxing. And these conditions now, the rise of Hitler, Francisco Franco, etc., the West, you know, the democracies weren't helping. They were doing the same thing. They had to link, the Union of Militant Deists had to link their activities with other revolutionary social institutions, the Cosmonaut, the trade unions, etc. So Gubelman, he was at the Department of History and Philosophy, the USSR Academy of Sciences, began his so-called educational work. He put together a 2-volume book on the officially sanctioned history of religion. Can you imagine? I've looked at pieces of some of his work, and you know, as much as Ludwig Feuerbach was an excellent thinker, you know, he was wrong, of course. Feuerbach was at least interesting. This man was not even interesting. But he was useful for the moment. So it isn't as if this stuff may have changed shape, but the agenda was always the same. So in 1940. The first postgraduate course in the history of religion was organized within the Academy of Sciences. And at no point did the punitive repressions stop. There were just fewer and fewer churches and clergy to attack. 1939, another 900 Orthodox clergymen were shot. And in 1943, in the midst of this war, another 500. And in that period of time, another 3,000 were just murdered outright. So you have Stalin's apologists, and some of them even claiming on the right that, well, the numbers of clergy murdered decreased. That's tantamount to Stalin withdrawing the repression and even reviving the church. But there was almost no clergy left to shoot. By the eve of the war, by the eve of Hitler's invasion, there were about 100 functioning churches and not a single monastery throughout the whole country. As we all know, the clergy were either in exile, or they were either in exile or underground. And of course, there is a third option. They were in the camps, and God forbid they were dead. But as Solzhenitsyn said, and many others, only after the Soviet Union fell, that the catacomb church was extremely large. But that's almost impossible. You know, there's indirect evidence of it, but not direct evidence for obvious reasons. Now, because of this dependence that we started off this talk talking about, Stalin made Yaroslavsky Gubelman, who was by this time a member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party, he was forced to write an article called Why Religious People Are Against Hitler. In other words, after spending years doing everything he could to bulldoze the church, literally and figuratively, he now has to talk about how enlightened religious people are because they hate Hitler. Or alternatively, that to be enlightened, you have to hate Hitler if you're religious. And that's no different today, of course. But you talk about a total change in tone. And of course, he did it without complaining very much. So despite everything, the main atheist groups didn't lose Stalin's trust, but they did avoid active work, at least for the time. Yaroslavsky was actually an editorial board member of Pravda. Again, Soviet Academy of Sciences, higher party school, and he was awarded the Order of Lenin then in 1943 he won the Stalin Prize. And that was, of course, the same year that Stalin met with Sergius, Alexei, and Nikolai, September 4th, in fact, to revive a church that he could control. To think that this has anything remotely to do with reviving the church period is the height of naivete. But on September 5th, Pravda's front page, you see this sensationalized almost like a New York Post-style report about Stalin's meeting with these bishops, and to give the impression that there's a semblance of a church now, and of course to use it for his own purposes. 3 months later, God showed mercy on his people and took Yaroslavsky Gubman. He died on December 4th, 1943. This is supposed to be the period of time when Stalin was avoiding persecuting the church, despite the fact that we know what happened when Germany went into Ukraine and parts of Russia. Church life revived. So when Yaroslavsky dies, you had obituaries sent from every institution, from the Central Committee, Council of People's Commissars, the Presidium, the Central Committee of the Cosmonol, the Institute of Marx, Engels, Lenin, and all the rest. And it's interesting, though, remember, this is in the middle of the war, we're talking a late 43, and all the articles dedicated to the memory of Gubelman, not a syllable was ever uttered about his anti-religious activities. There was no condolences, for example, from the Union of Militant Atheists, which in 1943 kind of stopped its direct propaganda for very obvious reasons. It existed officially until 1947, and they transferred their action to the All-Union Society of Knowledge and Science, or Science and Knowledge. So after the war, everything was resumed. And even in the late 50s, they had a new godless five-year plan. So the only reason there was any kind of a pause was obviously because of the war. The manpower simply wasn't there. It couldn't possibly be a priority, despite thousands of clergy underground and otherwise being shot. That would also include in places like Ukraine and Belarus. But in 1954, we're back to, July 54, the Central Committee. This is the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Their resolution was called on major shortcomings in scientific atheistic propaganda and measures to improve it. And the instruction was very plain: to saturate the entire educational system with atheistic content. In other words, to get to the American university system in a much quicker way. This is the American university system in 2023. It was done, there was violence involved in the 60s and 70s, but it primarily was not a violent movement. But in the Soviet Union in 58, there was a decree, again, not a published one. It was revealed in the 90s. The decree was passed to crack down on religious vestiges. And then you started seeing articles mocking the clergy, sex abuse stuff, your typical propaganda. And it became common in the central and local press. And what they really loved, if you wanted a good job in the Soviet Union at the time, if you were a clergyman and then you renounced God and the church, you were pretty much automatically privileged. Now, Vladimir Moss says this, and he's talking about, and I've talked about this before, but one of the great errors in studying the Soviet Union is that somehow Stalin was alone, that he was this aberration. In his the gulag camps, his repression, his violence, his purges, famines. He wasn't. Everyone acted like him. Lenin and Trotsky were far more vehement than he was. They just didn't have the institutions that Stalin had, that he ended up inheriting and creating. By the 50s, there wasn't a whole lot left. Things were developing underground. Things were developing. So the only spontaneous movement was church revitalization. But let me quote Vladimir Moss here. And he's talking about the kind of the post-Stalin anti-religious system. On October 4th, 1958, the Central Committee sent a secret letter to the Union Republics called on the inadequacies of scientific atheist propaganda. All party and public organizations, state organs, were required to attack the church. There followed the Khrushchev persecution in the years 59 and 64, when most of the seminaries and monasteries and either 12,000 to 15,000 parish churches, the religious survivals or vestiges of Soviet people were destroyed. In accordance with the instructions of the Central Committee and Khrushchev personally, on October 16th, the Council of Ministers accepted the first anti-ecclesiastical resolutions on monasteries in the USSR and on taxing the income of enterprises of diocesan administrations and also the income of monasteries. Those are very long-winded titles. But you see, reducing parishes from at least, when we say 100 churches, we're talking about officially sanctioned ones. But this 12,000 to 15,000, first of all, shows the explosion of churches after the German invasion, which should include them, not to mention the new territories in the West, including Western Ukraine, that were taken by the Soviets after the war. So that explains the large number of parishes developing. But they had to be destroyed, taking places like Western Ukraine, etc., into the Soviet system required the complete cleansing of their church structure. So you have a lot of new parishes that came into existence that were very quickly that were destroyed, at least on paper. Again, the only real spontaneous movement within the Soviet Union was to rebuild these churches in periods of chaotic life. Now, you see, when you talk about how the party viewed itself in different eras of the Soviet Union's existence, they're always talking about when the arrival of socialism is going to show up. The dictators would say this pretty much every year, that we're on the cusp of this, you know, so long as more church people are killed, more investment from the West, whatever, then we'll reach it. But the 21st Congress of the party was in 1959. What was left of the church, especially in the new territories, the trials and the closure, destruction of churches preceded 1959. The complete and final victory of socialism was yet again declared. And this is why, from 59 to 61 especially, you had or 64, I should say, the persecutions reached Stalin levels again. Then they said, a few years later, the building of communism will be complete by 1980. That was in 61, the 22nd Congress. They began referring to the church as, quote, the only legally existing enemy of Marxism. And they're talking about their own pet church, not just the underground. 1959, specifically 364 parishes were closed. Now, those, by the way, were the average Stalinist rates of closures. Under Khrushchev, in 1960, it reached precisely 1,398. 2 years later, 1962, it reached 1,585. A lot of this in Ukraine. And, of course, they simply blew up some of them, like the Cathedral of St. Alexander Nevsky in Kharkov in eastern Ukraine. Now, needless to say, things like, you know, pilgrimages and the Holy Springs and roadside chapels that were big in the Tsarist era were closed. You had about 700 springs and these local holy places and shrines that were covered up, destroyed, or whatever. They had to specifically stop bell ringing, and they needed to compulsory registration of baptisms and weddings in an Orthodox context to keep track of these people. And just like in America in 2023, Orthodox people were constantly being dismissed from work, excluded from any educational institution. They're called terrorists. Because, you know, it's no different. It's the same leftists, no matter what generation we're talking about. If you were an Orthodox believer, no matter what else, no matter how loyal you were in every other respect, it became impossible to enter a university or really to build a professional career. This is why having the membership in some atheist group, a society of knowledge, whatever the heck they were calling it, having that in your back pocket was important, whether you believed it or not. Even to the point, and this should sound familiar to you, depriving believers of parental rights. And this is mostly a local concern. And as I've spoken of at great length, the rise of using the psychiatric hospitals and psychology as a punitive measure really picked up steam, actually really began in this period of time. It's one of the things that made Khrushchev, that era anyway, Khrushchev's persecution different from Stalin's. But the agenda was the same. Violence was still used, you know. It just got slightly more sophisticated. I'm going to quote Vladimir Moss again here, and this is definitely worthwhile. Another aspect of the Khrushchev persecution, so-called because he was the chief inspirer and strategist of it, was the infiltration of agents into the ranks of the church. Anatoly Golitsyn, who defected from the KGB in 1961, said, As part of the program to destroy religion from within, the KGB in the late 50s started sending dedicated young communists to ecclesiastical academies and seminaries to train them as future church leaders. These young communists joined the church not at the call of their conscience to serve God, but at the call of the Communist Party in order to serve that party and to implement its general agenda in the struggle against religion. As regards the ordinary priests, Father Alexander Borisov writes, "Almost everyone was recruited into the KGB. I myself was recruited, and I know that our other priest, Father Vladimir, was also recruited. I think those who say they were not recruited are deceiving us. After all, in earlier times, one could not become a bishop without making some compromise. It was simply impossible." I know Vladimir Moss has, despite our occasional disagreements, has tremendously added to our knowledge of the new martyrs through works like this. But the church continued to grow despite all of this. In 1958, there were 63 monasteries. There were 13,372, many of which I already mentioned were in the far west. But by 1966, this was down to, well, roughly half, 7,523 churches and 18 monasteries. Places like, again, this is, I keep saying, mostly in the west, the Kiev Pechersk monastery and the seminaries there were closed in Lutsk and a whole bunch of other places. And so once the Western, the newly acquired parts of the Soviet Union after the war, once these were cleansed, there was only three seminaries and two academic theological academies remaining. And it also meant that the selection of students for this, for any kind of ordination later on, was controlled by the official commissioners for religion. The reason you had a growth in the church in the West and a few other, you know, places outside of Moscow is because the Soviet leadership needed to kind of fool the West for one thing, but for another, you know, the resources just weren't there anymore. It's hard to tell how many of these were actual functioning parishes versus underground churches that weren't, that wouldn't be, of course, officially registered. But there was a council, Bishop's Council, I don't want to call this a synod or sobor, in 1961, which approved, they had no choice, approved the demands of the Soviet authorities on how parish life is going to be restructured. Okay, we can't destroy them. We're going to control them. And one of the ways they did this, is removing any connection of the priests from the parish. This is something else that Peter the Great did, making him an employee of the parishioners. The body of 20 parishioners, the parish council, which was created at the time, you had to be party functionaries to be on the council, and it was created for very obvious reasons. There was no such thing as church property, even if it was strictly by donations. And treating priests as simple, almost like employees, was a way to remove them from any kind of real normal connection, organic connection to parish life. So technically the phrase was, they were hired by the servants of the cult for the satisfaction of religious needs. And any other diocesan meeting or council concerning parish life was suspended. And even after the war, by official sources, believers made up roughly between 30 and 40% of the population. After the war, I mean, these people had made sacrifices for the defense of their, what they thought was their country. And this means that they were willing to defend physically their churches and temples. You had in Klintsy, in Bryansk, you had violent clashes with the security at the time. Now, of course, it was rarely possible, as many have noted, to physically defend, you know, successfully churches. Because even if they were successful, it was rare, they just simply used lawsuits. From 61 to 64, almost 1,300 people, including clergymen, were sentenced to prison and exile and gulag for these kind of things. The only example, I think Vladimir says this, but It was the Pochi of Lavra in eastern Ukraine, where the physical, you know, the townsmen, the monastics, fought the authorities and forced them to relent for a time. That was one case where an uprising was actually successful. So I know I'm coming to the end of the hour here. I'm not sure if I'm going to continue this next time, but the way it's broken down, you have three of the major attacks on the church. The first from 1917, 1923. That was very crude. From 1932 to 1940, I do want to include the war in that. And here, you know, you had a lot of people joining the catacomb church, you know, which was very large. It started in the 1920s. And I'm willing to say that by the 1960s, they had millions of believers, although, of course, we can never know the precise numbers. And then, of course, the Khrushchev was the third, using psychiatry. And the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia or abroad did try to, however naive this is, it still was something they needed to try to involve the Western Christian world in an attempt to influence Soviet policy. More and more came, especially the immigrants and refugees from the Soviet Union. Solzhenitsyn, a few years later, became important. You started having Soviet embassy protests, all kinds of public information in the media and everything else. And some of the worst, you know, we started off this talk talking about this, that absolutely pathetic letter to Stalin. But the people who were most vehement were the visiting Soviet bishops in the West. And people like Konstantin Zachiev, the Archimandrite in the U.S., saw this as the official final apostasy. And that's when they began to call the church in the USSR, you know, satanic. Because that's when these Soviet bishops would come over and condemn and get all red-faced, angry. There was no such thing as persecution here. And of course, you know, the church in Moscow was being pressured from all sides. We talked about the Khrushchev attacks. The flimsiest of pretexts could be used by local party officials to shut down whatever they wanted. And you didn't have resisting bishops. Job of Kazan, Andrei of Chernigov were sent to prison. Benjamin of Irkutsk was arrested. Ion of Ulanovsk was dismissed from his post. Gromadzin retired twice in Tashkent. And, you know, the church was tolerated because of the World Council of Churches, which they joined right away. And the point was to take advantage of the almost universal Western ignorance in the policies over there to promote Soviet foreign policy. But even Gleb Yakunin, Nikolai Achtelman became known in the West from this. There was some glimmer of understanding. The Patriarch Pimen was one of the worst. He said, "I must declare and I take full responsibility for my words. There is not a single case in the Soviet Union where someone was persecuted or imprisoned for their religious beliefs. And I will go even farther and say, Soviet legislation does not provide for punishment for religious beliefs," end quote. And this was normal at the time. And so you especially had Protestant bodies saying, well, the Soviet Union is not anti-religious. You had a lot of politicians from both parties talking like that because of Pimen's words. And he was aware he was lying. He had received thousands of letters from those being persecuted. But the Westerners believed him. Anyway, I may finish this next week. I'm not 100% sure. I want to talk about Brezhnev for a little bit. But they kept on saying, these dictators in the Soviet Union kept on saying, real socialism isn't until all religious belief is destroyed. And that was pretty much the first two-thirds of the Soviet Union and their policy on orthodoxy. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.